You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on psoriasis hosted by Med Learning Group. This podcast is the first in a series of two geared towards dermatologists, advanced practice providers, and others involved in the management of psoriasis. In this podcast, Dr. Joel Gelfand will discuss the underlying pathophysiology of psoriasis and how treatments have evolved in recent years to where we are now. My name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Gelfand, who's joining us today. Dr. Gelfand is James J. Layden Professor of Dermatology and Epidemiology and Director of the Center of Clinical Sciences in Dermatology and Director of the Psoriasis and Phototherapy Treatment Center at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Delighted to welcome you here today.
You know, it's great to be with you, Chris. Med Learning Group is best in class CME education for our colleagues. And so I'm always delighted when I have an opportunity to work with you and your colleagues.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks very much for saying. But let's start with a quick background here to set the stage. Who and how many are affected by psoriasis in this country? And what are some of the existing gaps in care that you see?
Well, you know, psoriasis is a very common disease. If you're a clinical dermatologist or working in a dermatology setting, it's one of the top 10 most common conditions you're going to see in your practice. And among those top 10 conditions, it's the one that's most challenging to treat. So, the top 10 conditions are like acne and warts and skin cancers, things of that nature. Those things are very easy to manage. You know, psoriasis is a complex, multi-system, chronic disease with many treatment options. And so it's really important providers know a lot about this disease. You know, more broadly, it's roughly 2 to 4% of the population in the United States. That's roughly 8 million people. The prevalence varies a little bit based on race and ethnicity, but it's common essentially in all racial and ethnic groups. Interestingly, there's some disparities we see in the United States. One is underrepresented minorities, Hispanics, African Americans, tend to be underdiagnosed for psoriasis. We know this from CDC data that we analyzed years ago, where basically two dermatologists were looking at photographs, standardized photographs of patients or people who are being evaluated in a public health study by the CDC. And when people were asked, have you been diagnosed with psoriasis, people who are African-American or Hispanic were more likely to say no when the dermatologist looked at that photograph and said, oh, this person has psoriasis, basically. So that's important to be aware of. There's also some relative less use of biologics or most advanced therapies in African-Americans, and we're trying to understand that better. Some of it we think may be related to the educational approaches we take, the importance of making sure people understand what biologics are, how safe they are, and how effective they are. So we have some opportunities to improve our clinical practice from this information.
So let's talk a little bit about the pathogenic mechanisms of psoriasis. So without getting too complicated, what's the underlying pathophysiology of this disease, and how does it relate to clinical targets of therapy that are being discussed and pursued?
Well, this is a classic chronic inflammatory immune-mediated disease. It's a model inflammatory disease, and it's really probably the model of Th1, Th17-mediated inflammatory condition. If you think about how our science has evolved over time, in the 1980s and beforehand, it was thought to be a disease of epidermal proliferation, and the immune cells were just there because they were irritated from all the overactive keratinocytes. In the 1990s and early 2000s, it was thought to be a Th1 disease. And then really once IL-17s and IL-23 inhibitors came available, fundamentally it's felt to be a Th17 disease because the disease responds just so incredibly well to therapies targeting that pathway. It certainly has a strong genetic basis. Roughly 40% of people will have a family history of psoriasis. There are fairly strong inheritance patterns in families. So a person who has psoriasis has about, roughly a 30% chance of the child developing psoriasis in their lifetime. And strikingly, a lot of the therapies we use, there are genetic markers of. So people who have defects in IL-23 or mutations in TYK2, or more or less likely to develop psoriasis, depending on how that mutation is working. And of course, we have therapies, you know, targeting those genetic pathways, TYK2 therapies and IL-23 therapies as well.
Now, there's a variety of therapies for mild disease. I wanted to hone in on a little bit on the more difficult to treat cases. So for moderate to severe disease, let's say you've progressed through some of the initial conventional and topical treatments. What do the data show for the next step of treatment, namely biologics and commonly used oral therapies?
Yeah, well, hopefully here in 2023, my colleagues, when they're taking care of a patient with psoriasis, aren't sort of going through some step therapy algorithm. You know, the current way of thinking now is that really we should be using the best therapies, early on in the course of disease, based on the patient's underlying health situation, their preference, and the objective severity of what's going on with their skin. The old days, the idea is that, well, you would start with a topical, then you might try phototherapy, then you might try methotrexate. You know, the newer therapies are so well tolerated and so effective that we no longer go through that sort of stepwise approach. Basically the way I think about it is what are our strategies available to us? You know, we have topical therapies, some novel ones that could be quite helpful. We have phototherapy, ultraviolet light, which can be very helpful for patients, especially those who, for whatever reason, want to avoid pharmaceutical or medication-type products, because there's a lot of patients who sort of had that concept in mind. We have pills by mouth. The classic ones we don't really use a lot anymore. Cyclosporin, I haven't written a script for that in a long time. Methotrexate is still valuable, but not really as a primary therapy for psoriasis in my mind. I tend to use methotrexate in people who, say, have difficult to control arthritis, or people tend to cycle through biologics a lot. And so methotrexate in some cases can extend the life of a biologic in a patient. And you have, oral medications, apremilast, which has been out for quite some time now. Apremilast is very popular with patients because patients often prefer pills instead of injectable medications. And it doesn't require any laboratory monitoring. It's perceived as pretty safe. But its downside is it's not terribly effective. Very few patients get to clear or even almost clear in that medication. So from my perspective, it's not a drug I use that often. And then we have deucravacitinib, which is a TYK2 inhibitor, the newest oral therapy. And this is a major step forward, I think, in the oral management of psoriasis because, as I mentioned earlier, patients often prefer oral medications over injectable medications. The advantage of deucravacitinib is it's a once-a-day medication, not twice a day. So from a compliance point of view, it's likely to be easier for patients. And head-to-head trials, it's clearly more effective than apremilast and better tolerated. The patients are less likely to stop the drug due to, nausea, diarrhea, or other gastrointestinal side effects. I think for TYK2, deucravacitinib, really the downsides is that one is the FDA gave it some warnings around things like malignancy, lymphoma, and that's often alarming to patients to read that. Those risks seem to be very low. And for a new molecule, it's going to take time to really fully determine whether or not that's really drug related or not. And the FDA gave it some warnings around things like, triglycerides that need to be monitored. I think most of my colleagues feel like that's a probably not so necessary. It's very unusual based on the clinical trial data to see meaningful changes in lipids on this therapy. But in theory, there is some recommendations for blood monitoring on it. And then we get into biologics. In biologics, we have three strategies. We have TNF inhibitors, IL-17 inhibitors, we have IL-23 inhibitors. And so they each have their strengths and their weaknesses. TNFs have been around for two decades now. They work across many indications, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, things of that nature. So they're often useful in people with certain comorbidities, but need to be avoided in other comorbidities. Like, for example, it could cause demyelination. So you don't want to use it in someone who, say, has a history of optic neuritis or multiple sclerosis, for example. TNF inhibitors also carry warnings for malignancy, and that is anxiety-provoking for our patients. So that's a concern that has to be dealt with. And compared to our more novel therapies, the 17s and the 23s, they're just not as efficacious, and people tend to lose response to them and don't persist on therapy as long. But for people with significant joint disease or some of these other related comorbidities, they're often a very good option. Then, you know, the 17s are known for their rapid onset of action. We have three and actually now four choices in that arena. Secukinumab, ixekizumab, those are 17 alpha inhibitors. And then now we also have a brodalumab, which is a receptor blocker. That one's not as popular because it has a REMS program around suicidality. So that's a little bit harder to navigate in the clinic. And then the newest kid in the block is Bimzelx, bimekizumab, which finally got approved by the FDA. It's an IL-17A and F inhibitor. And what's striking about it is its efficacy. Basically, a 50 to 60% chance of being 100% clear, far exceeding our other biologics to date, and just a remarkable success level of driving the disease into remission. And we think about all the inflammatory diseases known to mankind, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, MS, you name it. None of them have therapies like we have in psoriasis that achieve this level of clinical response. I think to continue the thought on bimekizumab, you know, the strengths are clearly how well it works. The dosing's fairly easy. It's you know, monthly for 4 months and then every 2 months thereafter. I think its downsides is that clearly has a higher rate of candida. You know, I think you'd expect roughly 15 to 20% of your patients are going to develop a yeast infection over a year on it. That's trivial to deal with, easy to deal with. But in my clinical practice, I've had problems where the patient develops a candidal infection, doesn't come back to me, and ends up seeing a primary care doctor and goes down, you know, a pathway of a bunch of referrals to various doctors to sort out what's going on. It's a very easy thing to manage, diagnose, and treat. So patients need to be aware of what to look for and to be in touch with us. Similar to the other IL-17s, there's a warning for inflammatory bowel disease. It probably could trigger that problem in people. It's very rare. And the FDA gave it kind of a tough label. FDA gave it a label about concerns of suicidality, roughly 3% rate of suicidality in the treated group compared to about 1% in the placebo group. And so that's in the label. Also gave it a label for monitoring liver function tests. Some patients experience liver function test abnormalities. My view of the data is that I don't think this is a causal relationship. It seems to be a sporadic issue. But that is in the label, so clinicians need to be aware of it. And then finally, to round out the discussion, the IL-23s, of which we currently have three of them. And their advantage is they have infrequent dosing, you know, roughly every 8 to 12 weeks, so patients really like that. They tend to be very persistent. People are unlikely to lose response to it. And they essentially have no contraindications, which is amazing. You know, almost any therapy we use has contraindications. Unlike the IL-17s, which are sort of shouldn't be used in people with inflammatory bowel disease, or the TNFs, which shouldn't be used in people with certain underlying medical conditions like demyelination, the 23s have no contraindications, which is pretty remarkable.
Well, it sounds like we're in a pretty revolutionary time for psoriasis treatments. And I mean, you know, just in your discussion here, you've mentioned over a dozen agents, a lot of these which have come out in the past 10 or 15 years. So there's been a lot of advancements. In your practice, what would you say are some of the remaining unmet needs with the current group of treatments? I mean, based on what you just said, efficacy doesn't seem to be a problem. It seems to be more of putting the right person on the right drug, and then they'll have efficacy and try to be able to pursue clear skin. But what do you see in your practice? Does tolerability remain an issue? And I know you alluded to that before. I know some of them are injections. Is that a problem? What do you see in your practice?
So, you know, strikingly, we have to sort of disentangle the data I'm talking about, which is from clinical trials, to what actually happens in clinical practice. And invariably across all domains in medicine, all fields of medicine, the response rate you tend to achieve in trials tends to be better than what you'll see in real-world data, real-world clinical practice. Some of the biggest problems we face in clinical practice is a loss of response to therapy over time. And this is especially more common in people who are overweight, people who are obese, women. And then, you know, anyone who's lost response to one therapy is likely to have a higher risk of losing response to another. And so that's a big unmet medical need, is the ability to have a treatment we could give a patient and know that they could manage what is essentially a lifelong disease for as long as they need to. And, you know, in my practice, it's roughly 50-50. You know, half of patients seem to do well as expected, and they do well in a therapy long term. The other half seem to cycle from therapy to therapy. And that can be very challenging for patients, a little bit of a roller coaster, because I think once you've achieved clear skin, patients express they feel like they're like it's getting out of jail, like they can be free again and live a normal, full life. And it is very anxiety provoking and causes a lot of burden and suffering for a patient to lose response to a therapy. So that's a big unmet medical need. Second big unmet medical need is, therapies that really don't need to be used lifelong. You know, when you're talking to a patient in clinical practice, you know, maybe they're 25 years old, you know, and they say, well, how long do I need to be on this treatment, doc? And it is, I think, intimidating to people or overwhelming to people to say, well, you need to be on this therapy for life. It's not going to cure your disease. Okay. And what we don't know right now is who are the people who really do need lifelong therapy? And which patients can we step down in dosing or maybe take holidays off of it for a long period of time without any adverse sequela in their skin? That's a big unmet medical need that we need to sort out. And then the other issues that are out there is sort of issues around therapies that patients prefer. So we have outstanding injectable medications to choose from. And we really only have amongst the oral medications, which patients often prefer, is basically one to choose from for the most part. I mean, certainly apremilast is very popular and an excellent option for some patients. But, you know, ideally therapies that are very simple to take, maybe need to be taken once a week or once a month instead of on a daily basis. Those that are very well tolerated, certainly deucravacitinib, for example, is very well tolerated relative to, say, apremilast. So there's a lot of opportunity here for improvement in the oral medications. We are making progress in topical medications, a product called tapinarof cream. It's an aryl hydrocarbon reductase inhibitor. Striking medication. Some patients get remissions from their psoriasis for a while. That's a really nice advance, but a good number of people get folliculitis, which could be a problem for them. And not everyone clears on that therapy. Roflumilast, which is also a PDE4 inhibitor, like apremilast is, that's available topically now. And what's really nice about it is it's sort of, you can use one cream anywhere in the body. You know, we used to, and still to some extent, we'll give patients incredibly complicated regimens, you know, three different creams or lotions or solutions to use on different parts of the body on different days of the week. That was really hard for people, having just one treatment as an advance. And finally, coming back to one of our older therapies, ultraviolet light phototherapy, this still remains a very popular option for our patients, especially, you know, if we think about a lot of individuals out there don't want to be on medications. They don't want to be on pills by mouth or injectable medications or prescriptions. And ultraviolet light is as natural as it comes. It's sunlight, basically, or a wavelength of sunlight that can be very effective. Here, the advances we need are in ways of better delivering home phototherapy. We have excellent machines, but, you know, access to care is not great. Insurance coverage is not great. The model itself is not great because some people need phototherapy on a chronic basis. Some people need it once a year. And so it would be a much better situation if we could have a way of maybe leasing equipment to people. They use it when they need it, for example. And then making office treatment more accessible. You know, ironically, office treatment is so inexpensive relative to biologics, yet insurance makes phototherapy incredibly expensive to the patient. So a patient may have to pay, I don't know, $1,000 out of pocket for phototherapy due to copays in the office. an insurance company will pay $80,000 a year for a biologic, and the patient will pay nothing because the pharmaceutical company covers the copay, for example. And so we have a lot of issues, not just in the therapies available to be used and what the unmet medical needs are, but also our delivery system and things we need to improve in order to make sure patients really have the ability to fully access the options they need to manage their disease.
Now, I wanted to end on this. In our second podcast, we'll be discussing the JAK and TYK2 pathways a little bit more in depth. But just by way of background here, maybe 60 seconds or so, how are these new targets different from, say, TNF inhibition, IL-17 inhibition, and the other biologics in general?
Well, at least for TYK2, it's probably closer to an IL-12, a 23 pathway than certainly a TNF pathway. Although you're also hitting some aspects of the innate immune system as well, targeting all aspects of what we think is the immune pathogenesis of psoriasis. So distinct mechanism of action, clearly from what we currently have available. And time will tell in the clinic, is it going to be as helpful for other immune-mediated diseases beyond the psoriasis? How well will it work for psoriatic arthritis? We'll look at indications for inflammatory bowel disease, for example, and other disease states that relate to psoriasis.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Galfan. This has been an excellent discussion on some of the underlying mechanisms of psoriasis and how treatments have been designed across the years to hit different targets with, it sounds like, better and better outcomes. But that's it for now. Once again, thank you, Dr. Galfan, for joining us. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us as well. As a reminder, MedLearning Group offers many types of CME programs across a variety of disease states, including several dermatology topics. And I invite you to explore these on our website, www.medlearninggroup.com. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Bristol-Myers Squibb, who provided unrestricted grants for this educational activity. Thank you very much and have a great day.